Blog Talk Radio. To Research at the National Archives and Beyond, Blog Talk Radio. This is your host, Bernice Alexander Bennett. I want to welcome the callers and chatters to Research at the National Archives and Beyond. This show will provide individuals interested in genealogy an opportunity to listen, learn, and take action. This special edition of Research at the National Archives and Beyond will explore the issue of America's best-kept secret, 20th century slavery. If you have logged in as a guest and wish to participate in the chat, you can sign in through your Facebook account. I will also open up the lines in the second half of the show so that you can ask questions or give comments. Well, I have an outstanding panel tonight who will share with you their knowledge of 20th century slavery. The guests include Antoinette Harrell, Professor Claire Washington, and Rebecca Hensley. Now, for 10 years, Antoinette Harrell, renowned genealogist and television talk show producer, has unearthed thousands of state and federal documents relating to peonage. Peonage in the southern states grew out of a labor settlement following the emancipation of slaves. At the end of the Civil War, both black and white people throughout the South faced enormous political, social, and economic changes. In the southern states, many newly freed slaves remained on plantations. Harrell conducted a genealogy and reparations lecture in Admit, Louisiana, at All Nations Church. During that time, a woman named May Louise Miller walked in and stated that she and her family had been held as slaves in Gillsburg, Mississippi. Harrell did not doubt May's life story. Claire Washington, a transplant from Southern California, holds a B.S. with honors and distinction in black studies, an English and professional writing from Portland State University, and an M.S. in interdisciplinary studies from Portland State. Her scholarly research and teaching interests include women and resistance in the African diaspora, exploring the roles of the lesser-known women in resistance movements, both in the Caribbean and the U.S., during and after the period of enslavement. African-American cowgirls of the Old West and black women sharecroppers in southern U.S. She is currently an adjunct instructor in the Black Studies Department of Portland State University. Rebecca Hensley earned her master's degree in sociology at Western Illinois University. She has been an award-winning teacher for 20 years at six universities. Her primary area of interest is power relations, including race, class, gender, and globalization. Since arriving at Southeastern, she has introduced courses on gender and sexuality. She advises the Southeastern Sociological Association, a student organization. She also maintains a blog, Why Am I Not Surprised?, on the socially constructive political notion of race. So let me give a warm welcome to all three of my outstanding guests and begin with a question for Ms. Harrell. Antoinette, let's talk about, when did you start conducting peonage research?
I started in 1998. My former husband at that time came home and said, Antoinette, after that article on your work in People magazine and that issue, there was people that wanted to talk to me about their life as slaves in the 20th century. And so he organized a meeting for me to meet them at their homes, at one of the people that was there, their homes. And when I got there, Bernice, first of all, thank you for having us on your show tonight. Let me just go back with that. There was over 70 people in the room, and I could not believe this. And I had took the time to set up the camera and created this form that I can have them to fill in. And, Bernice, I could not believe what they was telling me, but I wasn't surprised. Mm-hmm. But they did not want to go, they did not want to talk about it in the public. And then in 2000, 2 years later, I met a woman named May Louise Miller. No relations to me. I was married to a Miller, but no relations at all. And mm-hmm. she walked into the conference, the workshop that I was holding in Amit, Louisiana, and she said, me and my entire family was held as slaves, and our father was still alive at the time. He was 105 when I first met him. And that's mm-hmm. how, and when she gave me her story, I wasn't surprised, because the people in St. Charles and St. John had already told me that they was held as slaves.
But can you imagine having 70 people facing you and sharing this information to you in, what you said, 2000?
No, this was 1998.
1998, nevertheless.
Someone's home.
Nevertheless.
And I was
that's
shocked.
So recent.
Yeah, I was really shocked. I was asking the questions about, where was you during the civil rights? Many of them had no idea that slavery was over. They was on plantations, sugarcane plantations. That's the kind of plantations they was on. But mm-hmm. It was a lot of horrible stories that came out of that. Listening to the people talk about being beat, being scared for their lives. And what really made them not want to talk about it, Bernice, is the fact that they were still in the areas where the same political strongholds had control over the people there, as well as employment and the police department.
Yeah, so I could imagine why they would be afraid
yeah.
to share this information. They had to go back home. They were afraid
yeah.
for their lives.
Yes, and I would not put their lives in harm's way at all.
Certainly. Could you tell us briefly about some of the people or the families you met that were held as slaves in
yeah,
the 20th
one,
century?
Especially the one, the Wall family. I just really want to go back to the Wall family. When I first met this family in Louisiana and I saw the conditions that these families was living in, it was beyond what I could comprehend as anything besides third world poverty in a third world country. Because they had only got their freedom since 1962. And so we're talking about the year 2000. And so that was I saw some of the residue from the families some of the members not being able to read and write. But one of the things, my most important interview was with the man that was 105 years old. He was mm-hmm. able to give me names of people who held him as a slave, where they held him, and how they went into slavery. Now, let me tell you how this family really went into slavery for the second time. At one time, his in-laws did own land in St. Helena Parish,
mm-hmm.
and so did he and his wife. But when they lost their land, the land was taken away from them. There was 40 acres that was taken away from the family. And so when you enter into the system called sharecropping, that became a slavery system for them, because that's what they was taken from place to place, beat, had to eat lizards, frogs, and I'm not talking about anything he was cooking. He was eating these things raw. So it was a very, very, very difficult life for the family. But a lot of the families that I met in Mississippi, some of them still live in some really, really bad conditions there. And it was just, it's a sad story. It really is, just to hear people talk about the fact that they didn't get out of slavery until 100 years later, after the Emancipation Proclamation was signed.
I mean, so many people reacted to the recent PBS special with shock and sadness. And what you're saying is that 10 years ago, you came right in front of people who were sharing this information with you. So this wasn't something that just happened yesterday.
No,
this is
no.
something that's been going on, as
yeah.
you say, 100 years later.
That's right. Matter of fact, the family was on Nightline with Ted Koppel in 2003.
Mm-hmm.
People's Magazine did an article for me in 2007. But if anyone would go to the Internet and type in Peonage or 20th Century Slavery or type in my name, they will see that we have always left a trail, you know, hoping that some people would pick up the story. But it was very difficult to get people to pick the story up. BlackNews.com carried it. And then when I met Professor Hensley and Professor Washington, well, they came on as scholars, along with my mentor, the late Dr. Ryan Walters.
Well, let's hear from Professor Claire Washington and Professor Hensley. What's your general reaction to what was uncovered by Antoinette Harrell as well as Ron Walters?
This is Claire Washington, and thank you. Yes, thank you so much for having us on your show.
You're so welcome.
I had no idea. First of all, I thought when slavery ended that it was a sign of Emancipation Proclamation, because that's what I learned in school, in history. And in 2007, I had received a Fulbright grant to go to the Caribbean to do research on resistance, women in resistance in that area. Well, my brother-in-law, who lives in Las Vegas, and sister sent me an article, a People Magazine article, on the Wall family. Now, mind you, I never had any interest at all in history or what happened in the past. It didn't matter who it was, I had no interest. So it took me a while to finally open the email and read it. But when I read it and I looked at the date, and I just was blown away about it, and I thought, wait a minute, this can't be. So the first thing I did was contact the writer, the author of that article, Bob Meadows, and emailed him and told him I was interested in contacting Ms. Harrell and Ms. Wall if I could. So he gave me Ms. Harrell's phone number, and I called her that night, and it was a life-changing call for me for the rest of my life, because the thing she told me, I never knew anything about slavery past the Emancipation Proclamation because I had no interest in the past. But after I got off the phone with her, I cried so much. I said, something's got to be done to let people know. So I wrote my mentor, I emailed my mentor, and I was to be coming back home. It was a year over there, and I was coming back home that summer. And I wrote my mentor and told him I had an idea for a new class, a new course. And I told him I wanted to call it African Americans, the 20th Century Slavery, and I told him a little bit about Antoinette and what she'd uncovered and the Wall family. And he says, well, what about your research? And I said, well, I'm going to design a course around that, but you got to let me teach this class. Just try it out for the summer. Well, he's so sweet. He does. That's what he does. Anything that I design or any of us junior faculty design, he asks us to try it out in the summertime to see what it does. As soon as I got back, I called Antoinette, got on the phone with her. She gave me so much more information. I was back in the States, so I was able to get information from her, talk to her a lot, designed a course, taught it that summer, and it was filled. The classroom was filled. So I ended up teaching it the coming fall, and I still teach it. And my students, the reason that it's so popular and it's always requested is because my first students that I taught in 2008, the summer of 2008, about 20th century slavery and the information and videos that Antoinette had sent to me, they went on out and they told other students, and then they tell other students, and then that, you know how it goes. And so when my students hear this, like today in class, It's not twisted your slave. I'm teaching right now. But today in class, that subject came up. And one student says, who had taken the class last fall, says, you have to take her course when she teaches 20th century slavery. And that came up about that. And you cannot believe the students who, all races, say, really? Really? Because they don't know anything beyond that. But once they take the course, they are so enlightened that they just want to do something.
And what about some of the other faculty members? Have they audited your class? I mean, do they participate?
My mentor, he who is the chair of our department, he has, and he does. The other faculty, their research is so far away from mine. They'll come and maybe come to one session or, you know, maybe once, but they're not, you know, they don't really promote it. Like, their research is so different that they're doing so much other things. So my chair does, so he does.
Mm-hmm.
But they do tell students when they're looking for courses and say, oh, well, I've taken that, I've taken that. They do, all the faculty say, well, have you taken Claire Washington's course in 20th century slavery? No, what's that about? And then they tell them a little bit about it, and they oh, yeah, let me try it. And once I say, once the students come in there, they are so enlightened that they tell their friends, their family, and it's like their family is the same way I was, and they are when they first come to the course, you know, because they can like, okay, well, I want to see what this is about. But we're not giving them the proof that, yeah, it exists, and they totally just drawn in, and they have to feel they have to go tell somebody, and they do.
Well, I can just imagine, I mean, how enlightening a course like that is. You know, I didn't even know anything about peonage until I listened to one of Antoinette Harrell's shows. And it was a life-changing experience just to have that information shared. And so many people out there are talking about it now simply because of the PBS special. But as Antoinette and you said, this is something that you all uncovered many, many years ago. Well, Rebecca,
yes, ma'am.
Tell us a little bit about your thoughts on the awareness level and what you've uncovered as far as peonage.
Well, Bernice, I do want to say thank you also for having us on the show. It's always exciting and enjoyable to be able to share what we learn with other people in a broader scope audience. And it's a pleasure to hear about Claire Washington's course. I certainly would love, Professor Washington, to get a copy of your syllabus and take a look at what you're doing, because it sounds very exciting. I could try to maybe do something like that in our department down here. I think it would be popular as well. I met Antoinette because she came to Southeastern Louisiana University to make a presentation on her genealogy work. And I went up to her afterwards and we started talking, and one thing led to another, and she started talking to me about peonage. Since that time, I've had the opportunity and the pleasure of and the amazing learning experience of kind of following her around at different times. I went down to New Orleans to see the premiere of her first documentary on 20th century slavery. I went several times with her to the Delta in Mississippi to go on a poverty tour and learn more about what it looked like on face value, and to get to meet Dr. Ron Walters, also on one of those tours. And I got to meet May Walls and hear her talk about her experiences and her story. I actually have been studying race relations for about 40 years, and I thought I knew a good bit. I mean, I have really explored the topic. I've had the benefit of a lot of input from a lot of people of color that have really helped me to get a firm grasp on all the nuances that a lot of times the average person just doesn't know. But this just knocked me out. I mean, I had just never even imagined such a thing. And when May Wall stood up at the premiere in New Orleans and talked about how she was not only raped so many times that she could never have children herself, her father would be beaten bloody, and then he would lie down on the ground on their dirt floor of their shack, and the whole family would lie on him as their pillow, the only pillow they ever knew. They would drink water out of a moss-covered pond that had things floating in it because that's the only option they had. They ate out of a tub full of slop, the kind of thing that most people would put out for the pigs or something. It would just be pulled out with the scraps from the house in it and shoved out by a tree, and they were expected to eat out of it. They never used a spoon. She never wore shoes. It was absolutely mind-blowing.
It's
and
almost
here
unbelievable.
Here was this woman standing there talking about this experience.
Mm-hmm.
Within our lifetime period,
mm-hmm.
It was beyond comprehension, really.
Absolutely, it just doesn't even sound real.
It
but
doesn't.
obviously, it was a real. It was real. You saw it. You were there. So heartbreaking.
It is
heartbreaking.
It is, and it's hard. When I just watched the Slavery by Another Name on public television on Monday night, and of course I had been, I've owned the book for a while and had been in that, but I hadn't seen the special until Monday night, and I strongly recommend that people who are listening, who are at all interested in that, could, I'm sure they will repeat it on public television, but if you go online, you can actually see that on the public television PBS.org site. You can watch it, I don't know how long, but at least for a few weeks, full length for free online. So if you miss it and can't watch it on television, you could at least see it on a computer. And it really is worth going out of your way to see, because this is exactly what we're talking about. But the special is very, very graphic and very helpful in terms of adding to what we're saying.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you think, all three of you for this matter, think that because the special has been out that perhaps people are going to pay more attention, or is it just kind of the flavor of the month and then it's gone and we're going to forget about it?
God, I hope not.
Well, Bernice, I would like to say that I hope that I see a change for the people that are still living in these slavery conditions.
Mm-hmm.
And I sort of paid attention to what people was talking about last night on Facebook, and no one ever asked a question, are there still others on plantations? What could we do? What type
mm-hmm.
of conditions are the people living in? And so I'm hoping that once people get beyond the initial shock of what they heard, but what really surprised me is that we just really went knocking on every door, every avenue to tell people, look, you know, we need your help. There's still people left in what I call now slaves of poverty once they came out of those conditions of being held as slaves. But I was really surprised by the fact that there was a lot of those that didn't open up for us as we tried to tell people. And so when Professor Washington came on and said, look, you know what, I'm going to teach it in my classroom. And so there was hope there. And then when Dr. Janita Watley came down this summer with seven student ambassadors who became ambassadors for students against poverty and penance. Well, many people ask me the question, well, Antoinette, why didn't you write a book? We was really too busy trying to feed families
mm-hmm.
and help families. I mean,
mm-hmm.
you know, that was a very tough decision, but the decision was easy because I had to help someone. And so all the footage that we have collected over the years of interviewing families and looking at these type of conditions, and I'm hoping to see that more people like Professor Washington and Professor Hensley will come aboard and say, you know what, it's time for us to do something about this now.
Yes, yes, definitely. Now, you produce, you mentioned the production of a story, the untold story, Slavery in the 20th Century. So what was included in that documentary?
Well, when I watched the documentary last night with Doug Blackman, it was the same. It was the letters to the presidents. It was letters from some of the people that was writing. But most importantly, we didn't have someone that was a descendant of someone that was held as a slave. We had the person themselves, Mae Louise Miller. And let me tell you something, Bernice, a lot of those shut in her face. There was a lot of people that said, this couldn't be. This woman is telling a lie. This didn't happen. This didn't happen. And Bernice, no matter how many documents I put in that documentary, we could not, one, get financing for it. Two, one of the things I noticed last night with Georgia Pacific being one of the finances of that documentary, I have documents right now where they was involved in the slave trade in the 20th century.
Yet you couldn't get anyone to provide you with the financial backing.
With the financial backing, the doors were shutting in our face, and it was so disappointing because sometimes, you know, Bernice, I put my life on the line. There was many times I left my home and I didn't even know if I would return. And, you know, not to mention driving 5 and 6 hours one way, you know, to go into these areas. And I spent years and years in this area. You know, and having to build relationships with people so that they can trust me to talk to me. And so when Dr. Ron Walters came, validated in 2003 on Nightline, Dr. Ron Walters and I met at the State of the World Black Conference in New Orleans maybe about 5 years ago. And I walked up to that stage and I said, Dr. Ron Walters, I need you to come to the Mississippi Delta to look at those that are still left in impoverished conditions and on plantations. He called me the next day and made arrangements to come down to Louisiana and Mississippi, and that's when Professor Hensley and Dr. Ryan Walters and I, we did a two-hour radio show to give a voice to the people who was left on those cotton plantations back in Mississippi.
Bernice, the thing that a lot of people don't realize is that there is a direct connection. It's not just that people are still stuck on these plantations and in these sharecropping situations and in other very similar manifestations of this kind of situation, but on top of that, and I think this is really one of the reasons why some people and some funders don't want to look at this, it's because there is a direct connection between these kinds of practices coming all the way up into the 1960s and to today, and the fact that even in big cities, you have such frustration and such disappointment and such debilitation and such rage and of the ordinary African-American population. And this is connected to the discouragement and the disenfranchisement and the shutting out of people and the ignoring of what has been done and is still being done to them, that it manifests itself in black-on-black crime, for example, you know. And they don't want to make this connection. They want to make it look like it's just a that's just the way African Americans are. You know, they don't want to look at why all of these things are connected so that we can actually address the responsibility and lay it at the feet of those who are responsible so that things can be done in communities that would make it possible for people to not just survive but come out of poverty and experience a new wholeness and have their needs met in very real, practical ways.
But would you look at this and say, well, this is a way to perpetuate a cheap labor force?
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
No question.
No question.
Which
well, we're going
always,
to.
That's always what they want to do in a capitalist society. I don't mean to get, you know, economic on us, but really, that's part of the whole scene is that they make that point in Slavery by Another Name. Certainly, Antoinette and I have talked about it a lot of times, and I'm sure it crops up all over Professor Washington's course, that this was a way to make the United States rich.
Oh, yes. The students are quite wise in that. They understand that.
Yes,
yeah.
I can imagine you can see it after you sit down and you explore it and you say, wait a minute, what's really going on here?
Mm-hmm. One of
well, we're going to take a quick break and come right back in a minute. Okay, everyone?
Sure.
Okay.
Welcome back. We're having a very interesting discussion on 20th century slavery. I mean, this is really a very, very difficult topic. On the program tonight, you're talking to Antoinette Harrell, Rebecca Hensley, and Professor Claire Washington. Okay, ladies, you were just talking about the whole economic issue relating to slavery. And any more comments on that particular issue?
No, I did want to add something where Professor Washington is concerned. There was a family that was sold for $20, a family of five, and Professor Washington flew to Louisiana twice to make that trip with me to the Mississippi Delta as well as Louisiana. And some of the documents that we revealed during this research, I'm very surprised that many people didn't pay very much attention to a family of five being sold for $20 in 1926. And this was not an issue that we didn't talk about. Now, with Professor Washington teaching the class, and we taught the class online, we did that for 6 weeks, not to mention mm-hmm. so many other, a lot of other information that was put out there in the form of documentaries. We are just about finished editing a documentary, Life on Still on the Plantation, where Professor Washington and Professor Hensley is a part of that documentary and showing that people are still on the plantation. But I'm more concerned with how do we begin to educate the masses, as Queen Mother Harriet Tubman said, I could have freed more if they just would have realized that they were slaves.
Mm-hmm.
And in my time, in the 21st century, I can say, I could have freed more if others just would have listened to me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and when I tell you, I went to the NAACP in Mississippi, SCLC, people like Tavis Smiley, let me see who else, I can go down the list, Al Sharpner. All of these people were very well aware of the Wall family.
Mm-hmm.
But I just could not understand why was it that anyone did not even want to touch this. It was almost like, you know, the doors was closing instead of opening, saying, what are you talking about? Let's hear what you have to say. But when this man, who was 113 when he passed away, the other lady that was 100 and I think she was 102, her babies actually lived with the dogs. And this was in 1938. She got her freedom. The FBI had to come in. So these reports and these documents, I mean, we had a case in court. Not only did I revealed the research, but we also took it to court.
We have a question coming in because you actually took this particular case into court.
That's right. That's right. We took this case to the courts, and that's why Nightline picked it up, because we was in the court, and the Wall family was in court to talk about what happened to them, but the case was dismissed out of the court because of the statute of limitations. Now, let me tell you what happened. When we reappealed that case, one of the things that the judges, because we had to appeal the case, and there was three judges on the panel, they said, how are you making the connections? This is what they asked our attorney. So the attorney said, we have a genealogist on board. So the first thing the judge said, that explains the connections there. Because first of all, let me say this to you. Many of the attorneys did not understand the important role that genealogy had to play with building these cases.
Yes, and you know what, Antoinette, I want you to tell us more about some of the records that you uncovered as a genealogist to really make that case. We do have a caller in with a question from area code 214. Caller, do you have a question or a comment you'd like to make?
You better put your glasses on. That's 314.
You're right. I definitely need to put my glasses on.
Well, you know, I was going to ask, you know, that's a very good point you made up about the genealogy. But what would it take for you to be able to do your job more effectively? And also, I'm sure that you could probably need to maybe be like 25 people doing the same thing that you're doing, because the stories that you just spoke on tonight is by no mean, by any stretch of imagination, the only one.
No, it's not. Like any other person that has a story, if I'm a researcher, well, certainly I wouldn't be the writer and the camera person. It took a team of people to help Doug Blackman produce the documentary. And I'm more to show that just with trying to apply for grants, you know, to get fundings, because most people would say, look, you know, I have to get paid for doing what I'm doing. But in my case, we definitely had to go and feed people. When I tell you we found people that needed food, clothing, we went to one house and the family was Professor Washington and Hensley went in this house, and the mildew was up to the ceiling. And there was absolutely no flow, if that's what you really want to call it. So my hands were so full, and I really want to give a thank you to Bev Smith, radio talk show, that picked us up, and she carried us for many, many months on her show. But, again, it was so important that people like myself say, you know what, should I free someone, should I help someone if I'm not getting paid? And so,
well, you know, that seems to be always the one compromising problem is that Black America don't have the ability to pay for their own freedom, even when it comes down to doing things that you're doing. And I keep and I really appreciate what you're doing. Matter of fact, I'm gonna try to get your information. Maybe we can get you on a talk radio show here where we are in St. Louis with Bernie Hayes on. Maybe you've heard of him. But until we start to work diligently with hard planning and strategic planning on how we're going to better our economic position here in America, especially along the lines of, I'm not talking about just plain old businesses, I'm talking about viable businesses. We're going to continue to approach things like what you're approaching from a very weak and subtle position. And no one pays any attention to you when you're weak.
But what you're talking about doing is forming a movement and having people all over the country mobilize to really take action to at least, number one, they're bringing it to the attention, but then what do you do with it once you go beyond the awareness stage?
Well, I don't know. I know that one of the things that we need to be doing is at least is video, getting video testimony from these people, because I hate to say it like this, but I don't think that during the time that they live that they're going to see very much progress from what we are seeing now. I would hope not, but I mean, we just have to face it. Things like this just don't work out as good for us as we would hope for them to work out.
Well, what I found is, you know, we have a lot of questions that is being asked, but remember now, we're sitting at a table that we're many people just finally learning this information. You know, what do we do? How do we approach this? What do we do now? My first goal was to bring awareness to the situation and mm-hmm. getting help from all the people who I came in contact with. And also at the same time, making sure that if we had to give food to people that was in need, do that as well. The blankets, the coats, the houses, whatever we had to do, do that. So I had a big task at my hand. And believe me, when you have limited resources and people that would say, you know, well, what is it that I can do? You know, I didn't have anyone funding gas for me to drive 5 hours away or paying for my hotel or buying the cameras that was necessary. I had to fund all of this out of my pocket. And so when I did come back and report it back to the various radio talk shows, because I've been on many talk shows, when I tell you many, there was a documentary that was done not very long ago where Dick Gregory and so many other people talked about the same subject. But what are we doing? You know, how can I get the churches? How can I get more universities, more people involved in how do we help those that was left behind?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, if I may say this, and I don't want to take up your show, I'm here in St. Louis and at the University of Missouri, St. Louis State College. You have African-American students, and I found out that some of them is carrying even like a 3.0 or better GPA, and they sleeping in cars and at the airport
mm-hmm.
because they cannot afford, you know, dorm. So it's just sad. And I appreciate what you're doing. I don't know what to say, but I know that you need money to do what you're doing. And, yeah, I mean, it's not going to work if you have to continue to come out of your pocket. But you don't went to some of the major organizations and they turned, they just basically hear what you said and went from there. But I don't know what to say, ma'am. I really don't.
Well, if I could, let me just put my phone number out there. It's area code 504-858-4658. And I want to say this in all fairness. Sometimes, and I have experienced this like many other people, we can beat that drum and we can bring a message. We don't hear that. People don't hear that message until someone that does not have the same complexion say that it happened, then we'll believe it. So I'm very grateful for the documentary, Slavery by Another Name. Now the question is for those of us that know it, what do we do to help the families that is still in these impoverished conditions? And my research, when I tell you I had to crawl in attics, go down dusty roads where there was only one way in and one way out, putting my life on the line, putting the people in the car with me, and everyone that got in the car with me knew it was a possibility. There was always this possibility.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't an easy drive. Professor Hensley can tell you, one morning we was due to go out and the people was being a little bit slow and I had to leave some people in a hotel because what they didn't realize, it was almost an hour and a half drive to the next location. The radio talk show, I had to pay for that out of my pocket, not for me to talk, but to give the radio to the people to let the world know what they was going through. And so when I say be ready for 8 o'clock, Professor Hensley, I really wasn't trying to be no other way, but they didn't realize how far it was in between the locations.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It was a distance.
It was a distance.
Antoinette has a mission, no question about it, and she when she gets a hold of you, she will teach you something, you know, and it's very exciting to be able to be around her because she does this work, she feels it with her heart, she means it, and she will keep you in the loop, you know, she will keep you wanting to know more, getting more, and then she encourages and gives you opportunities and options to develop ideas and thoughts. One of the things that I've been able to be a part of at various points is that I can put things on my blog on race.
Mm-hmm.
And I just discovered about a month ago, the blog has been up for about 6 years. And it's not a radio blog, it's a regular blog, but all I write about is race. And I just realized about a month ago that I have at least one reader in 175 different countries. That's how much people in the world want to know about the topic of race relations in the United States. You know, we may not have as many people listening as ought to be for some of the reasons that we've already been outlining. You know, it's money issues still. White people don't want to think about what's still going on, don't want to take responsibility for what needs to happen to change the way things are, want to keep pretending that they have earned something that nobody else has earned and that they deserve special privileges or special benefits. They want to keep pretending that, so they don't want to know these things. But as people like Doug Blackman and Antoinette Harrell and Professor Washington and I do the work that we're doing, and as people like you, Bernice, put us on the air and get that word out, then it makes it possible for more and more connections to be made and more people to become aware and not to be able to shut that window of information back down again.
Yes, absolutely. And we do need to continue to have various forums where that word can be shared with everyone. Well, I have a question for all of you. I mean, you talked about the value of genealogy, and I know, Antoinette, you did spend time at the National Archives uncovering information. Could you please tell us where did you look and what did you uncover?
Each time I went to the National Archives, and I really didn't have time to do my own personal genealogy research, I always was there on the mission of going into the Department of Justice files, the FBI reports, the NAACP files, looking at photographs, looking at some of the handwritten letters from the people that was held as a slave, who was writing to the presidents at that time, the standing president at that time, the governors, or anyone that they can get their hands on, as well as citizens of some counties and parishes. And I spent hours and hours and many times, different times, going to the National Archives to scan these documents. I think I scanned over 10,000 documents.
Mm.
And what I did find, I found that the majority of the people that was held as slaves was African Americans, but there was a percentage of poor whites, Hungarians, Polish, Native Americans, and Mexicans. And so when I found these documents, and some of these documents, court cases, there was court cases that I found, there was no photographs of black folks during that time that I in the folders that I was looking in, but there
mm-hmm.
was photographs of Mexicans and Italians. But one of the things that really, really got my attention was the letters to three presidents at that time. It was Warren, Harding, Theodore Roosevelt, Calvin Coolidge.
Uh-huh.
And also the governor of Mississippi was writing, Governor Earl Brewer was writing in 1921, asking the Department of Justice to come down, the Attorney General to come down and do an investigation. And so it was just so, the information was just rich information, and I could not believe that I was, like everyone else, I thought that slavery ended in 1865 as well, not until May gave her story, and I said, "Well, May, I may not find any evidence to place you on a plantation, but it will make me prove without a shadow of a doubt that what you are saying is the truth." And so when I started to find these documents that said that people had to dig their own grave, and they shot them in their own grave, you know, shot them in the grave, and mm-hmm. how, you know, and so the book that's called Worse Than Slavery is one of the books that I still have not finished reading today, because it's a very hard book because of all the horrible, demonic things that was done to people. There was women who tried to get their children off these plantations, and they would beat these women, and their children was left on these plantations, and they couldn't get their children off the plantations no matter what. It was just a lot. It was horrible things. One of the things that Doug Blackman's documentary pointed out was the justice of peace. And so when May said, when everybody asked the question, why didn't you run away? She said, where was I going to run to?
Mm-hmm.
You know, who could I talk to? And I remember her sister Annie saying, I didn't want to tell Antoinette these things. I had to know that we can trust Antoinette. It took me 3 to 4 years to build a trustworthy relationship with this family, because the things that they told me was in every letter that I read in the National Archives or every department FBI report. And when Professor Claire Washington came, and I want her to talk about the fact of how we stood in the very place where this family was sold for $20 in 1926.
Professor Washington, how did that feel to be there in the presence of a place where people were sold for $20?
It's I can't even describe it, because first let me go back to my enlightenment myself, my first trip to the Delta with Antoinette. After I met her and talked to her and the whole thing, I got there, and I confessed to her and to her great photographer, Mr. Walter Black. I confessed to both of them. I was of the mind, well, if I was on a plantation, I'd just run away. That was always what I was thinking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
well,
yeah.
They got me, took me there to the Delta. We were there, and all I could see, as far as I could see, was just cotton fields and fields and forests. And I changed my mind totally. And so I tell my students that now. I tell them the story, how they enlightened me, because I always was of the mind, well, I'd just run away. I would have ran away. I would have stayed. There was no way you could go.
There was nowhere to go.
No. The other thing is that I had just read the story about the family being sold for $20. And I had presented it to my class the same day that I read it, after they had shared it with me. And so, of course, researcher that I am, I had to go. I had to go see for myself.
Mm-hmm.
And when we got there, you know, I can't explain to you guys. I really can't explain to you the feeling that came over me standing right on the ground where this happened. Looking at the house, looking at everything around, and knowing that this family, father, mother, children, in their home, late evening, sleep, somebody comes in and take them all, the whole family, and sell them for $20. They have no choice but to go. It's just mind-boggling. That's all I can say.
Yeah, I mean, it would seem to bring a feeling of profound, profound sadness, anger, disgust.
Yeah.
I mean, I can just imagine just listening to you describe this family awakened and sold.
Yes, yes. The whole family for $20. It's mind-boggling. It's just, and to stand there and know that this did not happen in 1861, 62, 63, 65. This happened in 1921.
Mm-hmm.
And let me say this. when we talk about doing our genealogy research and some of our family members come up missing, we would not have known to look in the second coming of slavery. Why? Because we had no idea about this type of slavery. And
right.
So the place where I took Claire, that's where my father's family, and my father is from Fluka, Louisiana.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm doing research in a very dangerous part of Louisiana in Tangipahoa Hope Parish, still putting my neck on the line. Why? Because the families that held these families are one of the most wealthiest families in the parish.
Mm-hmm. Well, Antoinette, we have another question coming in from area code 504. You have a question or a comment? Area code 504.
Hello, Bernice. This is Walter Black. I was calling in. Hello, Rebecca, Professor Claire, Antoinette, and Bernice herself. I was calling in just to support the call this evening because I'm very much aware of the conversation and the subject that y'all are talking about. But y'all sound like y'all are enlightening some people who's on the line on the things that's still going on at this time.
And, Walter, you have been the person to document what you've seen and what they have seen. And so special thanks go out to you.
Yes.
For being there to provide that documentation with the images.
Yeah.
Thank you,
Walter.
Speaks
a lot. It's volumes of information.
And being a security person as well to... You know what? Because it wasn't easy for me to travel with everybody. When I think about Professor Hensley and Professor Washington and Walter, there was only a few people that I could have traveled with because you just didn't want to raise eyebrows about what you was doing. And there was many times that I had to just keep, you know, maybe sometimes they didn't know the danger that we was in, but I was always alert on what was going on. Watching cars that was behind us, making sure I didn't see the same vehicle two or three times. One of the most dangerous places that I ever felt that I was in Philadelphia, Mississippi, which is right down the road from Oprah's childhood hometown, Kosciuszko, Mississippi. And I really had to be very cautious because they was watching us. And there was times that I actually had to tell them that I was writing a dissertation or a thesis on my family reunion about my family members because I couldn't tell them what I was looking for.
Mm-hmm.
Because at one time I actually had to get permission from the sheriff to go into the attic to look for documents, and then when they found out I was up there, the books was already thrown up there all kinds of ways, and the pigeons was defecating and urinating on all the books, and the first thing they said is that I messed that entire attic up. And that was that way, their way for not letting me go back inside that
attic. To prevent you from going in there. Now, did you find or have you found that you at one point found a document, and when you wanted to go back and retrieve that document a second time, it was no longer there?
Oh, yes. I saw that in Mississippi many times. And so that's why I learned from the very beginning, you know, you get it as you go along because there's no second time. On this type of work, I always treat it as if it was my last time going. Let me get everything that I can. And something else that was very, very scary to deal with because of what was all involved was revealing the Georgia Roman Catholic priest records because the Catholic Church had, they held women as slaves, sex slaves. And so when the letter went to Warren Harding, the priest answered, he said, "I don't answer to your laws, I answer to the laws of Rome." You know, and so it was very, very, I had to really be very cautious of how I handled things because at any given time, you know, I never really let my guards down on what I was revealing because
mm-hmm.
we're talking about rich people, we're talking about wealthy people, we're talking about the Catholic priests, we're talking about presidents of the United States, we're talking about companies, over in Simpson County, Mississippi, they was disposing of boys over there between the ages of 13 and 15.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to look for those documents. And in most cases, we was always like the only black person in the place looking for documents. And so it really broke my heart because at that time I was researching this particular subject. I had a son myself that was 15 years old. And so when I read that document, you know, it just made me just cry. I mean, there was many times I just had to cry and let it out. And then when I come home, I didn't have a psychiatrist I can talk to. I didn't have anybody. Only thing I could do was get on my knees and ask God to help me get through this. Because they said they dispose of the boys. They didn't say how.
Mm. And what period of time was that? When was that?
1928, 1930.
Mm.
And so each place, each document that we scanned in the National Archives, I remember telling Walter this. I said, look, please do not read anything right now. You just scan and we'll read later. And I told Walter, said, if anybody stopped you and asked you what you was reading, what you was doing, Walter really couldn't tell them because I had already given him the instructions. Do not read anything. You're where you need to be. Just scan, and we'll go over the documents much later.
Mm-mm-mm. Well, it looks like we have another caller calling in. 314, you have a question or a comment?
I was calling back in to give some advice. I just thought of this. Of course, I don't know how you would do it without staying anonymous. But some of those stories about things that's continuing to go on, you should email that to the newspapers that's in China, Iran, and who else? Like Press TV. That is information that will embarrass this country. And you might, I mean, there's possibilities that there will be some results that come out of something good that come out of it. But Venezuela, for instance, countries that's always on the ridicule of the State Department here for violation of human rights.
Mm-hmm.
That's, you understand where I'm coming from.
Yes, yes,
yes.
Yeah. But I don't know how you would, it seemed like, is there some way that some college students can get involved in doing some of the recording and the compilation and paper emailing and stuff that's required from what you were, you know, trying to do?
Well, we have two professors on the radio with us tonight, so this may be something for them.
Well, I know after I teach my class, there's always one or two students. In fact, I'm looking online right now, and I see a student, first time I ever talked to students. Most of my students are returning students, but this is the first time I taught a student. Her name is Carrie Bowers. I taught her in the summer session, which is only 4 weeks compared to the regular year courses. But she took it the 4 weeks of 20th century slavery. And I see she's always, from that point, the fourth week, last week, she wanted to do something. I have other students who also have kept continuously asked, what can we do? Is it still going on? Is Mrs. Farrell still part of the Gathering of Hearts? What can we do? Let us know, you know. So there, I do have students who want to do something.
And have your students written papers and presented what they have uncovered, at least shared this information outside of Portland State University at other conferences?
No, they have not done that. But what they do is they do share it. They don't share it in like venues where there's large gatherings. You know what I'm saying? They share it with other students on campus, off campus, at youth community colleges, because they do it by saying, you know, when you transfer to Portland State, be sure you take this class. But as far as giving papers to conference, they have not, that I know, have anything ever done with that, anything like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to take a little quick break, and then we'll come back and continue our discussion about 20th century slavery.
Mm-hmm.
Welcome back to Research at the National Archives and Beyond. You're listening to Antoinette Harrell, Professor Claire Washington, and Professor Rebecca Hensley. Okay, where are we right now? I mean, we've talked about this issue. We've talked about finding documentation. So where do we go with this? What are your thoughts?
Well, my thoughts is, as always, is to make sure that I can help other family members that is left in the residues of slavery. Yes, Bernice, 1863, if we think about it, meant something to many of our families. Many of our families was able to buy homes and go to school and go to college and, you know, and sort of live comfortable. Well, for many families that did not get their freedom until 100 years later, many of us as black folks are, you know, 100 years, you know, in advance of those families. So there's so much work to do. You know, there's reading programs. There's just so much that's lacking in these areas. Now, my research revealed 16 states and 27 counties in Mississippi. So that's broad.
That is extremely broad. Yes, yes.
And so, and this is why it's very important to bring the awareness. Bring the awareness, teach, educate, bring on people like the two professors that's on tonight, more people in the media that can help get the word out, look at what we can do, get the students involved. You know, the poverty tours that we held in the Mississippi Delta was for a purpose so that people can really see not only was there people in these type of conditions, but there's a place called Webb, Mississippi, and there's about 8 or 9 little houses lined up, little shanties. I don't know if Professor Hensley went to that plantation, to that little area, but I know Professor Washington. Professor Hensley, did we ever take you there?
No, I don't recall that particular place. But we saw a wide range of various places that all evidence the same kind of really virtually horrifying situations that people were in, and people that were doing the very best they could to live a decent life in spite of the fact that they had you had to drive a long distance to go to a doctor, a long distance to go to a grocery, a long distance to go to find a job if you could find one, and with very small resources. I remember one man you were interviewing at one point, a young guy, who was talking about he had worked all day the day before digging ditches. He had worked 9 hours the day before digging ditches for $10.
$6.
Because his baby needed diapers.
That's right.
I mean, our initial reaction to you worked 9 hours for $10. Why would you even do that? Well, because his baby needed diapers and he had no other way to provide them.
Mm-hmm.
Our understanding of these situations is so lacking in terms of what real people's real lives are like that when Antoinette made us aware at Southeastern of these things, on one occasion, the club that I advised collected 30 big lawn and garden bags full of clothes, warm winter clothes. And other people in the community heard we were doing it and brought brand new socks and all kinds of people will respond if they become really aware, if they understand what's going on. People do listen. But they have to have the opportunity to learn. I mean, they're not just going to go find it out by themselves.
Yes, and so you need to create every opportunity possible to share that information as broadly as possible throughout the United States. Well, Antoinette and Professor Hensley and Professor Washington, are there any plans to pull those documents that were found at the National Archives and in the attics of some of the courthouses into a book or something, a compendium, so that at least others can look at it, understand it, even when they're doing their own genealogy. Think, maybe they need to look at the FBI papers if they can't find an ancestor, or look in the prison system, or look at the chain gangs. I mean, what can you do to get information out to people?
Well, I think right now, Bernice, I think it would be a little bit more easier for me than it has been in the past to get
mm-hmm.
things done now that the documentary Slavery by Another Name has aired. I don't think I'll have as much trouble with doors closing in my face. I just
mm-hmm.
want to say something to us as people, and I mean this has nothing to do with the color of our skin. We first have to stop separating ourselves from each other. That's the biggest thing that I found. Because even in little small areas like that, in the Delta, Mississippi, you have huge churches, and it's an elite club. And if the people there didn't have the money to put in the church or the clothes to wear, you know what? They wasn't welcome in that church. And the same thing with the organizations. When I went to the NAACP, I could not understand why up on their 100th year anniversary that they just celebrated, after me going to them and informing them of these documents, that they need to send their own archivists into the archives and
mm-hmm.
look at these documents and see what kind of cases was Thurgood Marshall talking about, James Weldon, you know, and I'm talking about Mary Church Hill, people that was known as pioneers and history makers, but then I revealed those documents, and it was as if nothing was ever said. And so it will not change as long as we keep turning our back. See, I
yes.
felt like every day that I came out of Mississippi or wherever I was at that time, that somebody was waiting for me to get help to free them. And I did my best. I came back. I went on the Internet, made contacts. We formed an organization called Gathering of Hearts, a nonprofit organization to collect clothes and food. So, you know, I'm wearing many different hats, but it's not a hat that just only Antoinette should wear.
That's
this
right.
This is an obligation for all of us. We can research our family history, you know, and when I think about researching family history, but when we learn that those that were still held as slaves, are we really trying to free anyone else? When I thought about the Juneteenth celebration, there was many celebrations. And when I went to the people that was putting on activities, I said, look, I know you're going to say you don't have the money to pay me, but just let me tell you, speak to the people about, yes, you're celebrating your freedom, but there's still some that's held on plantations. There was one place, one of the women that called me from Atlanta, she said, look, I want to take you somewhere. And she did. And she pointed out that building, a nice brick apartment that was okay for that area. She said, that's a plantation. So, and then other people taught me how to look for a plantation. One man told Walter and I, he said, you go back and tell people, stop looking for the houses with the, you know, the big house and the slave cabins in the back. He said, you see those trailers over there? That's a plantation. It's the system that
mm-hmm.
defines it as a plantation,
mm-hmm.
not
mm-hmm.
the houses that defined it.
Right.
Right.
And so when the man said to me, me and my family got put off the plantation, and if you see him and his wife and his children, you can see that he was in some type of illegal activity of slavery. So we're looking for, we have to see certain things that associate with slavery in the 1800s. But we would not look at that trailer park over there and see that, at, as they would call them, Boss Jones owned that plantation.
Right, right. We wouldn't even look at, I mean, the whole issue of trafficking women.
No. No, we would not. We would not.
Mm-hmm.
And so
mm-hmm.
I just want to say to those that are still left in those conditions, you know, I'm going to do everything in my power to bring about a change for these families. And to those of us that's hearing this, and after watching the documentary, and listening to Professor Claire Washington's class that we teach right here on my Blog Talk Radio, and everything that Professor Hensley is doing, we owe that to humanity. And sometimes I couldn't even come home and take a shower. I remember one day I came home and I was taking a shower and I turned the water off and I just had to scream. I just had to let it out because you know what? I felt this nice hot water running on my back. And I remember leaving the house where there was boiling water on a hot plate in a little pot to take a bath. I remember one lady, she was using a 5-gallon empty bucket of paint container as her bathroom. So when I came home and I felt the air conditioner and I felt all of it, and I said, you know what? I said, Father, I said, the least that I can do is help in some way. So when Professor Hensley heard me talk about the coat drive, she didn't hesitate. The students got involved. When Dr. Ron Walters came out to Mississippi, he didn't hesitate. And I can count him. When Walters said, Antoinette, I will go where you go, he didn't hesitate. When Professor Washington came down here twice, they didn't hesitate. I can count on just both of my hands the people who said, let's do something. We will help. See, there was people that said, no, we don't want to hear this from her. She doesn't have a degree in this area. See, I had to deal with so many different things. But then it was like Harriet Tubman, Queen Mother Harriet Tubman spoke to me and she said, you are not experiencing anything that I didn't experience. Frederick Douglass didn't experience. Dr. King didn't experience. And all the other pioneers. She said, you know you're doing the work when you have to cry. You know you're doing the work when doors are shutting your face.
Yes.
That's when you know.
That's when you know. And I hear such passion and love in your voice, Antoinette. And I hear a mission to change things. But you need help. This is not just an Antoinette problem. This is a national problem in our country. And our country needs to do more than put the letters in the National Archives. We need to get this information out and share it with people. And as you said, the special on Monday certainly created awareness.
It did.
It has people talking.
It really did. The disappointment with that is that Doug and I spoke. And I think that it could have been where myself or Professor Hensley or Professor Claire Washington, who have been doing this work, and if we look at the timelines here, I didn't realize that Professor Hensley wrote that blog, 6 years ago?
No, I've been writing the blog itself for 6 years. I didn't write the information since I've known you until about, I want to say 3.5 years ago or something like that, possibly 4.
Right. And I think that we have to realize that if someone comes to us and share information, and also I want to thank Robin for all the blogs that she wrote. All of us have worked together to bring awareness to everyone. And so this is not just to say that Doug Blackman exposed this work. This work was there before Doug Blackman, there before me through Pete Daniels, who wrote his dissertation in 1969. Dr. Ron Walters was writing his book, and his book was The Relationship Between the Department of Justice and the NAACP Files, but he died before it can be completed. We called a national press conference at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., to raise awareness on 20th century slavery and poverty. You know how much media coverage we got?
How much?
One camera, one news company. You know how many people came out? maybe 20 people came out. Mm-hmm. And that's what the camera people included and the staff. That's not just because I said, this cannot be happening. But it is. But now that Doug Blackman has said it, maybe it would give it a different twist.
Maybe it'll give it a different twist. It certainly will. Well, what, as we come close to the end of the show, where do you want people to take this information? All three of you, what's your hope and your desire for where we should go next?
Well, I'm writing a proposal to our university to maybe develop a capstone course where students from Portland State in my class could spend 2 weeks as part of the capstone, get credit for it, like 6 credits, I believe it is. Spend 2 weeks down in the Delta with Antoinette, and because they do want to do this, it's just that there's nothing in place. All they get it is in my classroom. And videos and interviews, but they really want to come and really, like I want to go to see where the family was sold from. So they want to do this, and so I'm writing a proposal now for this capstone course, and we'll be asking for Antoinette's help on that for, you know, get the right information so that we can get students have that experience there, and those students will certainly, they're going to be graduate students, some of them, they're certainly going to come back and do something. I know that.
So what you're saying that they will develop not only awareness, but some skills as far as activism skills, community
yes.
organization skills.
Yes.
To make a difference.
Yes, they will. They will.
Professor Hensley, what are your thoughts?
Well, I've taken a slightly different bent just lately in terms of because I've started to try to put together a prisoners' rights conference for later this year that will bring together advocates and activists and ex-offenders and scholars and lawyers from the region to look at prisoners' rights in Louisiana. Because we have a horrendous record. We have 4 times the national average of natural life sentences, and 3/4 of the men in the system here in Louisiana are black. So we're looking at some of those issues, but I'm also teaching a social movements course right now, and I'm thinking of ways that I can take this information tonight. You know, sometimes it takes a situation like this to kind of energize us to think, well, what is something more that I can do right now about this issue? Not to back burner the Prisoners' Rights Conference, or not to back burner the blog, not to back burner some of the other activities that I'm involved in, but to take this particular issue again and see if I can find a new application. Well, now that I've heard about Professor Washington's course and this capstone course, I could possibly expand some of the things that are being done on my campus to include, some of what she's already sort of pioneered, and see if we can't become in contact. I hope that we can do that, Professor Washington.
Absolutely. Yes.
And so that's something that I would personally want to do, because I try very hard to make it personal. You know, I think we all are those kinds of people, and it's real easy to say, gosh, look at that terrible situation. Somebody ought to do something about that. But when we say, what can I do? Then sometimes very good things can come out of just that simple question.
Yes, yes, you are so right. You're so right. And Antoinette, any parting comments from you?
Yes, I just want to, first of all, thank you once again for having us on tonight. And what I'm working on now is the completion of the documentary, Still on the Plantation, where we actually show people still on the plantation and where they will be able to get an opportunity to see some of the behind-the-scenes research that Brother Walter and myself had to go through as we went to look for these documents, because we need to be aware, someone looking like myself going in and someone like Doug Blackman going in to look for documents is totally different. So I need to show it from my perspective, because what it reminds me of is the fact that it was like saying, I don't need the slave to come and tell me that there's others on a plantation I know.
Yes.
You know. So,
yes.
So that's what I felt like. You know, slave, look, I know it. You don't come and tell me. We already know. We got you there. So this documentary with Professor Hensley and Professor Washington will reveal some behind-the-scenes things and documents that I have not revealed in my last documentary, but it will be revealed now. And to continue to raise awareness and to get help for the people that's there living in these type of conditions.
Well, that's a documentary that I'm sure we will all look forward to seeing.
Absolutely.
Well, I want to say to all of you that I really appreciate having you on the show tonight, that you provided the listeners with valuable information concerning 20th century slavery, and we cannot stop talking about it.
Absolutely not.
Let us continue this dialogue, because it is so very, very important, and you're doing an outstanding job, and thank you so much for coming on the show tonight.
And thank you for having me.
Thank you, Bernice.
Well, you are so welcome. And I want to just tell everyone that I do have a show tomorrow night, and I hope that you will join me and my special guest, Thomas Allen Harris. He is the founder and president of Chimpanzee Productions, for a lively discussion on searching for identity, family, and spirituality through sharing family stories and images in a virtual family reunion format called the Digital Diaspora Family Reunion Roadshow. So please join me tomorrow night at 9 p.m. Eastern Time and 8 p.m. Central, and I will put more information on Facebook about Thomas Allen Harris so that you all can have a very good idea of what this show is going to be like tomorrow. So good night.
Good night.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. And remember, your ancestors left footprints. Therefore, you should follow the clues that are presented to you through oral history, family records, research at the National Archives and beyond. Thank you for joining Research at the National Archives and Beyond. This is your host, Bernice Alexander Bennett. Good night, and I look forward to you joining me next Thursday. Good night, everyone.
Good night.
Good night.